Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of House Rules by Jodi Picoult, narrated by the Recorded Books Repertory Company and directed by Rob Grannis.
Case 1. Sleep Tight. At first glance, she looked like a saint. Dorothea Puente rented out rooms to the elderly and disabled in Sacramento, California, in the 1980s. Seven bodies were found buried in the garden, and traces of prescription sleeping pills were found in the remains through forensic toxicology analysis. Puente was charged with killing her boarders so that she could take their pension checks and get herself plastic surgery and expensive clothing in order to maintain her image as a doyenne of Sacramento society. She was charged with 9 murders and convicted of 3. In 1998, while serving 2 consecutive life sentences, Puente began corresponding with a writer named Shane Bugbee and sending him recipes, which were subsequently published in a book called Cooking with a Serial Killer. Call me crazy, but I wouldn't touch that food with a 10-foot pole.
Chapter 1. Emma. Everywhere I look, there are signs of a struggle. The mail has been scattered all over the kitchen floor. The stools are overturned. The phone has been knocked off its pedestal, its battery pack hanging loose from an umbilicus of wires. There's one single faint footprint at the threshold of the living room, pointing toward the dead body of my son, Jacob. He sprawled like a starfish in front of the fireplace. Blood covers his temple and his hands. For a moment, I can't move, can't breathe. Suddenly, he sits up. "Mom," Jacob says, "you're not even trying." This is not real, I remind myself, and I watch him lie back down in the exact same position, on his back, his legs twisted to the left. There was a fight, I say. Jacob's mouth barely moves. And? You were hit in the head. I get down on my knees, like he's told me to do 100 times, and notice the crystal clock that usually sits on the mantle, now peeking out from beneath the couch. I gingerly pick it up and see blood on the corner. With my pinky, I touch the liquid and then taste it. "Oh, Jacob, don't tell me you used up all my corn syrup again." "Mom, focus." I sink down on the couch, cradling the clock in my hands. "Robbers came in and you fought them off." Jacob sits up and sighs. The food dye and corn syrup mixture has matted his dark hair. His eyes are shining, even though they won't meet mine.
"Do you honestly believe I'd execute the same crime scene twice?"
He unfolds a fist, and for the first time I see a tuft of corn silk hair. Jacob's father is a towhead, or at least he was when he walked out on us 15 years ago, leaving me with Jacob and Theo, his brand new blonde baby brother.
"Theo killed you?" "Seriously, Mom, a kindergartner could have solved this case,"
Jacob says, jumping to his feet. Fake blood drips down the side of his face, but he doesn't notice. When he's intensely focused on crime scene analysis, I think a nuclear bomb could detonate beside him and he'd never flinch. He walks toward the footprint at the edge of the carpet and points. Now, at second glance, I notice the waffle tread of the Vans skateboarding sneakers that Theo saved up to buy for months, and the latter half of the company logo, NS, burned into the rubber sole.
"There was a confrontation in the kitchen," Jacob explains. "It ended with the phone being thrown in defense and me being chased into the living room where Theo clocked me."
At that, I have to smile a little. "Where did you hear that term?"
Crime Busters, Episode 43?
Well, just so you know, it means to punch someone, not hit them with an actual clock.
Jacob blinks at me, expressionless. He lives in a literal world. It's one of the hallmarks of his diagnosis. Years ago, when we were moving to Vermont, he asked what it was like. Lots of green, I said, and rolling hills. At that, he burst into tears.
Won't they hurt us?
He said.
But what's the motive?
I ask. And on cue, Theo thunders down the stairs.
Where's the freak?
He yells.
Theo, you will not call your brother.
How about I stop calling him a freak when he stops stealing things out of my room?
I have instinctively stepped between him and his brother, although Jacob is a head taller than both of us.
I didn't steal anything from your room, Jacob says.
Oh, really? What about my sneakers?
They were in the mudroom,
Jacob qualifies.
Retard,
Theo says under his breath, and I see a flash of fire in Jacob's eyes.
I am not retarded,
he growls, and he lunges for his brother. I hold him off with an outstretched arm.
Jacob, I say, you shouldn't take anything that belongs to Theo without asking for his permission. And Theo, I don't want to hear that word come out of your mouth again, or I'm going to take your sneakers and throw them out with the trash. Do I make myself clear?
I'm out of here,
Theo mutters, and he stomps toward the mudroom. A moment later, I hear the door slam. I follow Jacob into the kitchen and watch him back into a corner.
What we got here,
Jacob mutters, his voice a sudden drawl,
is failure to communicate.
He crouches down, hugging his knees. When he can't find the words for how he feels, he borrows someone else's. These come from Cool Hand Luke. Jacob remembers the dialogue from every movie he's ever seen. I've met so many parents of kids who were on the low end of the autism spectrum. Kids who were diametrically opposed to Jacob with his Asperger's. They tell me I'm lucky to have a son who's so verbal, who's blisteringly intelligent, who can take apart the broken microwave and have it working again an hour later. They think there's no greater hell than having a son who's locked in his own world, unaware that there's a wider one to explore. But try having a son who's locked in his own world and still wants to make a connection. A son who tries to be like everyone else, but truly doesn't know how. I reach out to comfort him, but stop myself. A light touch can set Jacob off. He doesn't like handshakes or pats on the back or someone ruffling his hair. Jacob, I begin. And then I realize that he isn't sulking at all. He holds up the telephone receiver he's been hunched over so that I can see the smudge of black on the side.
You missed a fingerprint, too,
Jacob says cheerfully.
No offense, but you would make a lousy crime scene investigator.
He rips a sheet of paper towel off the roll, dampens it in the sink.
Don't worry, I'll clean up all the blood.
You never did tell me Theo's motive for killing you.
Oh.
Jacob glances over his shoulder, a wicked grin spreading across his face.
I stole his sneakers.
In my mind, Asperger's is a label to describe not the traits Jacob has, but rather the ones he lost.
It was sometime around 2 years old when he began to drop words, to stop making eye contact, to avoid connections with people. He couldn't hear us, or he didn't want to. One day, I looked at him, lying on the floor beside a Tonka truck. He was spinning its wheels,
his face only inches away, and I thought, where have you gone? I made excuses for his behavior. The reason he huddled in the bottom of the grocery cart every time we went shopping was that it was cold in the supermarket. The tags I had to cut out of his clothing were unusually scratchy. When he couldn't seem to connect with any children at his preschool, I organized a no-holds-barred birthday party for him, complete with water balloons and pin the tail on the donkey. About a half hour into the celebration, I suddenly realized that Jacob was missing. I was 6 months pregnant and hysterical. Other parents began to search the yard, the street, the house. I was the one who found him, sitting in the basement, repeatedly inserting and ejecting a VCR tape. When he was diagnosed, I burst into tears. Remember, this was back in 1995. The only experience I'd had with autism was Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. According to the psychiatrist we first met, Jacob suffered from an impairment in social communication and behavior, without the language deficit that was a hallmark of other forms of autism. It wasn't until years later that we even heard the word Asperger's. It just wasn't on anyone's diagnostic radar yet. But by then, I'd had Theo, and Henry, my ex, had moved out. He was a computer programmer who worked at home and couldn't stand the tantrums Jacob would throw when the slightest thing set him off. A bright light in the bathroom. The sound of the UPS truck coming down the gravel driveway. The texture of his breakfast cereal. By then, I'd completely devoted myself to Jacob's early intervention therapists. A parade of people who would come to our house, intent on dragging him out of his own little world. I want my house back, Henry told me. I want you back. But I had already noticed how, with the behavioral therapy and speech therapy, Jacob had begun to communicate again. I could see the improvement. Given that, there wasn't even a choice to make. The night Henry left, Jacob and I sat at the kitchen table and played a game. I made a face, and he tried to guess which emotion went with it. I smiled, even though I was crying, and waited for Jacob to tell me I was happy. Henry lives with his new family in the Silicon Valley. He works for Apple, and he rarely speaks to the boys, although he sends a check faithfully every month for child support. But then again, Henry was always good with organization and numbers. His ability to memorize a New York Times article and quote it verbatim, which had seemed so academically sexy when we were dating, wasn't all that different from the way Jacob could memorize the entire TV schedule by the time he was six. It wasn't until after Henry was gone that I diagnosed him with a dash of Asperger's, too. There's a lot of fuss about whether or not Asperger's is on the autism spectrum, but to be honest, it doesn't matter. It's a term we use to get Jacob the accommodations he needs in school, not a label to explain who he is. If you met him now, the first thing you'd notice is that he might have forgotten to change his shirt from yesterday or to brush his hair. If you talk to him, you will have to be the one to start the conversation. He won't look you in the eye. And if you pause to speak to someone else for a brief moment, you might turn back to find that Jacob's left the room. Saturdays, Jacob and I go food shopping. It's part of his routine, which means we rarely stray from it. Anything new has to be introduced early on and prepared for, whether that's a dentist appointment or a vacation or a transfer student joining his math class mid-year. I knew that he'd have his faux crime scene completely cleaned up before 11 o'clock, because that's when the free sample lady sets up her table in the front of the Townsend Food Co-op. She recognizes Jacob by sight now, and usually gives him too many egg rolls or bruschetta rounds or whatever else she's plying that week. Theo's not back, so I've left him a note, although he knows the schedule as well as I do. By the time I grab my coat and purse, Jacob's already sitting in the back seat. He likes it there, because he can spread out. He doesn't have a driver's license, although we argue about it regularly, since he's 18 and was eligible to get his license 2 years ago. He knows all the mechanical workings of a traffic light, and could probably take one apart and put it back together. But I'm not entirely convinced that in a situation where there were several other cars zooming by in different directions, he'd be able to remember whether to stop or go at any given intersection. "What do you have left for homework?" I ask as we pull out of the driveway.
"Stupid English."
"English isn't stupid," I say.
"Well, my English teacher is."
He makes a face.
"Mr. Franklin assigned an essay about our favorite subject, and I wanted to write about lunch, but he won't let me."
"Why not?"
"He says lunch isn't a subject."
I glance at him.
"It isn't." "Well," Jacob says, "it's not a predicate either. Shouldn't he know that?"
I stifle a smile. Jacob's literal reading of the world can be, depending on the circumstances, either very funny or very frustrating. In the rearview mirror, I see him press his thumb against the car window. "It's too cold for fingerprints," I say offhandedly, a fact he's taught me.
"But do you know why?"
I look at him. "Evidence breaks down when it's below freezing."
"Cold constricts the sweat pores," Jacob says. "So excretions are reduced, and that means matter won't stick to the surface and leave a latent print on the glass."
"That was my second guess," I joke.
I used to call him my little genius, because even when he was small, he'd spew forth an explanation like that one. I remember once, when he was 4, he was reading the sign for a doctor's office when the postman walked by. The guy couldn't stop staring. But then again, it's not every day you hear a preschooler pronounce the word gastroenterology, clear as a bell. I pull into the parking lot. I ignore a perfectly good parking spot because it happens to be next to a shiny orange car, and Jacob doesn't like the color orange. I can feel him draw in his breath and hold it until we drive past. We get out of the car and Jacob runs for a cart. Then we walk inside. The spot that the free sample lady usually occupies is empty. "Jacob," I say immediately, "it's not a big deal." He looks at his watch.
"It's 11:15. She comes at 11 and leaves at 12.
Something must have happened.
"Bunion surgery,"
calls an employee, who's stacking packages of carrots within earshot.
"She'll be back in 4 weeks.
Jacob's hand begins to flap against his leg. I glance around the store, mentally calculating whether it would cause more of a scene to try to get Jacob out of here before the stimming turns into a full-blown breakdown, or whether I can talk him through this. "You know how Mrs. Pinham had to leave school for 3 weeks when she got shingles and she couldn't tell you beforehand? This is the same thing."
"But it's 11:15,
Jacob says. "Mrs. Pinham got better, right? And everything went back to normal." By now, the carrot man is staring at us. And why shouldn't he? Jacob looks like a totally normal young man. He's clearly intelligent. But having his day disrupted probably makes him feel the same way I would if I was suddenly told to bungee off the top of the Sears Tower. When a low growl rips through Jacob's throat, I know we're past the point of no return. He backs away from me, into a shelf full of pickle jars and relishes. A few bottles fall to the floor, and the breaking glass sends him over the edge. Suddenly, Jacob is screaming, one high, keening note that is the soundtrack of my life. He moves blindly, striking out at me when I reach for him. It's only 30 seconds, but 30 seconds can last forever when you're the center of everyone's scrutiny. When you're wrestling your 6-foot-tall son down to the linoleum floor and pinning him with your full body weight, the only kind of pressure that can soothe him. I press my lips close to his ear. "I shot the sheriff," I sing, "but I didn't shoot no deputy." Since he was little, those Bob Marley lyrics have soothed him. There were times I played that song 24 hours a day just to keep him calm. Even Theo knew all the verses before he was 3. Sure enough, the tension seeps out of Jacob's muscles, and his arms go limp at his sides. A single tear streaks from the corner of his eye.
"I shot the sheriff," he whispers, "but I swear it was in self-defense."
I put my hands on either side of his face and force him to meet my eyes. "Okay now?" He hesitates, as if he's taking a serious inventory.
"Yes."
I sit up, inadvertently kneeling in the puddle of pickle juice. Jacob sits up too and hugs his knees to his chest. A crowd has gathered around us. In addition to the carrot man, the manager of the store, several shoppers, and twin girls with matching constellations of freckles on their cheeks are all staring down at Jacob, with that curious mix of horror and pity that follows us like a dog nipping at our heels. Jacob wouldn't hurt a fly, literally or figuratively. I've seen him cup his hands around a spider during a 3-hour car ride so that at our destination, he could set it free outside. But if you're a stranger and you see a tall, muscular man knocking over displays, you don't look at him and assume he's frustrated. You think he's violent.
"He's autistic," I snap. "Do you have any questions?"
I've found that anger works best. It's the electric shock they need to tear their gaze away from the train wreck. As if nothing's happened, the shoppers go back to sifting through the navel oranges and bagging their bell peppers. The 2 little girls dart down the dairy aisle. The carrot man and the manager don't make eye contact, and that suits me just fine. I know how to handle their morbid curiosity. It's their kindness that might break me. Jacob shuffles along behind me as I push the cart. His hand is still twitching faintly at his side, but he's holding it together. My biggest hope for Jacob is that moments like this won't happen. My biggest fear? That they will, and I won't always be there to keep people from thinking the worst of him.
Theo. I've had to get 24 stitches on my face, thanks to my brother. 10 of them left a scar cutting through my left eyebrow, after the time that Jacob knocked over my high chair when I was 8 months old. The other 14 stitches were on my chin, Christmas 2003, when I got so excited about some stupid gift that I crumpled the wrapping paper, and Jacob went ballistic at the sound. The reason I'm telling you this has nothing to do with my brother, though. It's because my mother will tell you Jacob's not violent. But I'm living proof that she's kidding herself. I'm supposed to make exceptions for Jacob. It's one of our unwritten house rules. So when we need to take a detour away from a detour sign, how ironic is that? Since it's orange and freaks Jacob out, that trumps the fact that I'm 10 minutes late for school. And he always gets the shower first, because 100 billion years ago, when I was still a baby, Jacob took the first shower, and he can't handle having his routine messed up. And when I turned 15 and made an appointment to get my learner's permit at the DMV, an appointment that got canceled when Jacob had a meltdown over buying a pair of new sneakers, I was expected to understand that these things happen. The problem is, something happened the next 3 times I tried to get my mom to take me to the DMV, and finally, I just stopped asking. At this rate, I'll be riding my skateboard till I'm 30. Once, when Jacob and I were little, we were playing in a pond near our house with an inflatable boat. It was my job to watch Jacob, even though he was 3 years older than I am and has had just as many swimming lessons as I have. We overturned the boat and swam up underneath it, where the air was heavy and wet. Jacob started talking about dinosaurs, which he was into at the time, and he wouldn't shut up. Suddenly, I began to panic. He was sucking up all the oxygen in that tiny space. I pushed at the boat, trying to lift it off us, but the plastic had created some kind of seal on the surface of the water, which only made me panic even more. And sure, with 20/20 hindsight, I knew I could have swum out from underneath the boat, but at that moment it didn't occur to me. All I knew at the time was that I couldn't breathe. When people ask me what it's like growing up with a brother who has Asperger's, that's what I always think of, even though the answer I give out loud is that I've never known anything different. I'm no saint. There are times I'll do things to drive Jacob crazy because it's just so damn easy, like when I went into his closet and mixed up all his clothes, or when I hid the toothpaste cap so that he couldn't put it back on when he was done brushing his teeth. But then I wind up feeling bad for my mom, who usually bears the brunt of one of Jacob's meltdowns. There are times I hear her crying, when she thinks Jacob and I are asleep. That's when I remember that she didn't sign up for this kind of life either. So I run interference. I'm the one who physically drags Jacob away from a conversation when he's starting to freak people out by being too intense. I'm the one who tells him to stop flapping when he's nervous on the bus, because it makes him look like a total nutcase. I'm the one who goes to his classes before I go to my own, just to let the teachers know that Jacob had a rough morning because we unexpectedly ran out of soy milk. In other words, I act like the big brother, even though I'm not. And during the times when I think it's not fair, when my blood feels like lava, I step away. If my room isn't far enough, I get on my skateboard and tool somewhere, anywhere that isn't the place I'm supposed to call home. That's what I do this afternoon, after my brother decides to cast me as the perp in his fake crime scene. I'll be honest with you. It wasn't the fact that he took my sneakers without asking, or even that he stole hair out of my brush, which is, frankly, Silence of the Lambs creepy. It was that when I saw Jacob in the kitchen with his corn syrup blood and his fake head injury and all the evidence pointing to me, for a half a second I thought, I wish. But I'm not allowed to say my life would be easier without Jacob around. I'm not even allowed to think it. It's another one of those unwritten house rules, so I grab my coat and head south. Although it's 20 degrees outside and the wind feels like knives on my face, I stop briefly at the skateboarding park, the only place in this stupid town where the cops even let you skate anymore, although it's totally useless during the winter, which is like 9 months of the year in Townsend, Vermont. It snowed last night, about 2 inches, but there's a guy with a snow skate trying to ollie off the stairs when I get there. His friend is holding a cell phone, recording the trick. I recognize them from school, but they're not in my classes. I'm sort of the anti-skater personality. I take AP everything, and I have a 3.98 average. Of course, that makes me a freak to the skating crowd, just like the way I dress and the fact that I like to skate makes me a freak to the honors crowd. The kid who's skating falls down on his ass. "I'm putting that on YouTube, bro," his friend says. I bypass the skate park and head through town, to this one street that curls like a snail. In the very center is a gingerbread house. I guess you call them Victorians. It's painted purple, and there's a turret on one side. I think that's what made me stop the first time. I mean, who the hell has a turret on their house, besides Rapunzel? But the person who lives in that turret is a girl who's probably 10 or 11, and she has a brother who's about half her age. Their mom drives a green Toyota van, and their dad must be some kind of doctor, because twice now I've seen him come home from work wearing scrubs. I've been going there a lot lately. Usually I crouch down in front of the bay window that looks into the living room. I can see pretty much everything from there. The dining room table, where the kids do their homework. The kitchen, where the mom cooks dinner. Sometimes she opens the window a crack, and I can almost taste what they're eating. This afternoon, though, nobody's home. That makes me feel cocky. Even though it's broad daylight, even though there are cars going up and down the street, I walk behind the house and sit down on the swing set. I twist the chains around and then let them untangle, even though I'm way too old for this kind of stuff. Then, I walk up to the back porch and try the door. It opens. It's wrong. I know that. But all the same, I go inside. I take off my shoes because it's the polite thing to do. I leave them on a mat in the mudroom and walk into the kitchen. There are cereal bowls in the sink. I open the fridge and look at the stacked Tupperware. There's leftover lasagna. I take out a jar of peanut butter and sniff inside. Is it just my imagination, or does it smell better than the jiff we have at our house? I stick my finger in and take a taste. Then, with my heart pounding, I carry the jar to the counter, plus another jar of Smuckers. I take two slices of bread from the loaf on the counter and rummage in the drawers till I find the silverware. I make myself a PB&J sandwich, as if it's something I do in this kitchen all the time. In the dining room, I sit down in the chair that the girl always sits in for meals. I eat my sandwich and picture my mother coming out of the kitchen, carrying a big roast turkey on a platter. "Hey, Dad," I say out loud to the empty seat on my left, pretending that I have a real father instead of just a guilty sperm donor who sends a check every month. "How's school?" he would ask. "I got 100 on my bio test." "That's incredible. Wouldn't be surprised if you wind up in med school, like I did." I shake my head, clearing it. Either I've imagined myself into a TV sitcom, or I have some kind of Goldilocks complex. Jacob used to read to me at night. Well, not really. He read to himself, and he wasn't reading as much as he was reciting what he'd memorized, and I just happened to be in the same general geographic location, so I couldn't help but listen. I liked it, though. When Jacob talks, his voice rolls up and down as if every sentence is a song, which sounds really strange in normal conversation, but somehow works when it's a fairy tale. I remember hearing the story about Goldilocks and the Three Bears and thinking she was such a loser. If she'd played her cards right, she might have been able to stay. Last year, when I was a freshman at the regional high school, I got to start over. There were kids from other towns who knew nothing about me. I hung out the first week with these two guys, Chad and Andrew. They were in my methods class and seemed pretty cool, plus they lived in Swansea instead of Townsend, and had never met my brother. We laughed about the way our science teacher's pants were hemmed 2 inches too short, and sat together in the caf at lunch. We even made plans to check out a movie if a good one was playing on the weekend. But then Jacob showed up in the caf one day, because he'd finished his physics packet in some freakishly short amount of time, and his teacher had dismissed him. And of course, he made a beeline for me. I introduced him and said he was an upperclassman. Well, that was my first mistake. Chad and Andrew were so psyched at the thought of hanging out with an upperclassman that they started asking Jacob questions, like what grade he was in and if he was on a sports team. 11th, Jacob said, and then he told them he didn't really like sports. "I like forensics," he said. "Have you ever heard of Dr. Henry Lee?" He then yapped for 10 straight minutes about the Connecticut pathologist who'd worked on major cases like O.J. Simpson and Scott Peterson and Elizabeth Smart. I think he lost Chad and Andrew somewhere around the tutorial on blood spatter patterns. Needless to say, the next day, when we picked lab partners and methods, they ditched me fast. I've finished my sandwich, so I get up from the dining room table and head upstairs. The first room at the top is the boys', and there are dinosaur posters all over the walls. The sheets are covered with fluorescent pterodactyls, and a remote-control T-Rex lies on its side on the floor. For a moment, I stop dead. There was a time when Jacob was as crazy about dinosaurs as he is now about forensic science. Could this little boy tell you about the therizinosaurid found in Utah, with 15-inch claws that looked something out of a teen slasher flick, or that the first nearly complete dinosaur skeleton, a hadrosaur, was found in 1858 in New Jersey? No. He's just a kid. Not a kid with Asperger's. I can tell. Just by looking into the windows at night and watching the family. I know, because that kitchen with its warm yellow walls is a place I want to be, not somewhere I'd run away from. I suddenly remember something. That day, when Jacob and I were playing in the pond underneath the inflatable boat, when I started to freak out because I couldn't breathe and the boat was stuck on top of us, he somehow broke the suction cup seal of the boat on the surface of the water and wrapped his arms around my chest, holding me up high so that I could swallow huge gulps of air. He dragged me to the shore, and he sat beside me, shivering, until I could figure out how to speak again. It's the last time I remember Jacob watching out for me instead of the other way around. In the bedroom, where I'm standing, there's a whole wall of shelves filled with electronic games. Wii and Xbox, mostly, with a few Nintendo DS tossed in for good measure. We don't have any gaming systems. We can't afford them. The crap Jacob has to take at breakfast, a whole extra meal of pills and shots and supplements, costs a fortune. And I know that my mother stays up nights sometimes doing freelance editing jobs just so that she can pay Jess, Jacob's social skills tutor. I hear the hum of a car on the quiet street. And when I peek out the window, I see it. The green van turning into the driveway. I fly down the stairs and through the kitchen, out the back door. I dive into the bushes, where I hold my breath and watch the boy spill out of the van first, wearing hockey gear. Then his sister gets out, and finally his parents. His father grabs a bag of equipment from the hatch, and then they all disappear into the house. I walk to the road and skate away from the gingerbread house. Underneath my coat is the Wii game I grabbed at the last minute, some Super Mario challenge. I can feel my heart pounding against it. I can't play it. I don't even really want it. The only reason I took it is because I know they'll never even know it's missing. How could they? When they've got so much.
Jacob. I may be autistic, but I can't tell you what day of the week your mother's 32nd birthday fell on. I can't do logarithms in my head. I can't look at a patch of sod and tell you that it has 6,446 individual blades of grass. On the other hand, I could tell you anything you ever wanted to know about lightning, polymerase chain reactions, famous movie quotes, and Lower Cretaceous sauropods. I memorized the periodic table without even trying. I taught myself how to read Middle Egyptian, and I helped my calculus teacher fix his computer. I could talk forever about friction ridge detail in fingerprint analysis and whether said analysis is an art or a science. For example, DNA of identical twins is identical. We know that based on scientific analysis. But the fingerprints of identical twins differ in their Galton details. Which evidence would you rather have if you were a prosecutor? But I digress. I suppose these talents would make me a hit at a cocktail party if A, I drank, which I don't, or B, I had any friends to invite me to a party, cocktail or not. My mother has explained it to me this way. Imagine what it's like to have someone with an intense stare come up to you and start talking about medium velocity impact blood spatter patterns caused by objects moving between 1.5 and 7.5 meters per second, and how they differ from high velocity impact spatter from gunshots or explosives. Or even worse, imagine being the person talking and not getting the hint when the victim of your conversation is desperately trying to escape. I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome long before it became the mental health disorder du jour, overused by parents to describe their bratty kids so that people think they're super geniuses instead of simply antisocial. To be honest, most kids in my school know what Asperger's is now, thanks to some candidate on America's Next Top Model. So many people have mentioned her to me that they must think we're related. As for myself, I try not to say the word out loud. Asperger's. I mean, doesn't it sound like a grade Z cut of meat? Donkey on the barbecue? I live with my mother and my brother Theo. The fact that we emerged from the same gene pool is mind-boggling to me, because we could not be more different from each other if we actively attempted it. We look like polar opposites. His hair is fine and so blonde it could pass for silver. Mine is dark and gets bushy if I don't have it cut religiously every 3 weeks. Actually, part of the reason I get it cut every 3 weeks is that 3 is a good, safe number, unlike 4, for example, and the only way I can handle someone touching my hair is if I know it's coming in advance. Theo is always caught up in what other people think of him, while I already know what people think of me, that I'm the weird kid who stands too close and doesn't shut up. Theo listens to rap almost exclusively, which gives me a headache. He skateboards as if the wheels are attached to the bottoms of his feet, and I do mean that as a compliment, since I can barely walk and chew gum simultaneously. He puts up with a lot, I suppose. I get upset if plans don't work out, or if something in my schedule changes, and sometimes I just can't control what happens. I go all Hulk, screaming, swearing, hitting things. I haven't ever hit Theo, but I've thrown things at him and have wrecked some of his things, most notably a guitar that my mother then made me pay for in increments for the next 3 years of my life. Theo also is the one who suffers the brunt of my honesty. Case in point one. Theo walks into the kitchen wearing jeans so low that his underwear is showing, an oversized sweatshirt, and some weird metal around his neck. Theo. Sup? Me. Yo, homie, maybe you didn't get the memo, but we live in suburbia, not the hood. Is it Tupac Appreciation Day or something? I tell my mother we have nothing in common, but my mother insists that will change. I think she's crazy. I don't have any friends. The bullying started in kindergarten when I got my glasses. The teacher made a popular boy wear fake glasses so I'd have someone to connect with. But as it turned out, he didn't really want to talk about whether Archaeopteryx should be categorized as a prehistoric bird or a dinosaur. Needless to say, that friendship lasted less than a day. By now, I've gotten used to kids telling me to leave, to sit somewhere else. I never get called on the weekends. I just don't get the social hints that other people do. So if I'm talking to someone in class and he says, "Man, is it 1 o'clock already?" I look at the clock and tell him that yes, it is 1 o'clock already, when in reality, he's trying to find a polite way to get away from me. I don't understand why people never say what they mean. It's like immigrants who come to a country and learn the language but are completely baffled by idioms. Seriously, how could anyone who isn't a native English speaker get the picture, so to speak, and not assume it has something to do with a photo or a painting? For me, being in social situations, whether that's school or Thanksgiving dinner or the line at the movies, is like moving to Lithuania when you haven't studied Lithuanian. If someone asks me what I'm doing for the weekend, I can't respond as easily as Theo would, for example. I'll stumble over how much information is too much And so instead of giving a blow-by-blow description of my future plans, I'll rely on someone else's words. Doing my best De Niro taxi driver impression, I'll say, "You talking to me?" Mind you, it's not just my peers that I misunderstand. Once, my health teacher had to take a phone call in the main office, and she told the class, "Don't move. Don't even breathe." Normal kids ignored the statement. A few goody-two-shoes worked quietly at their desks. And me? I sat like a statue with my lungs on fire until I was on the verge of passing out. I used to have a friend. Her name was Alexa, and she moved away in seventh grade. After that, I decided to treat school like an anthropological study. I tried to cultivate an interest in topics that normal kids talked about, but it was so boring. Case in point two. Girl. "Hey Jacob, isn't this the coolest MP3 player?" Me. "It was probably made by Chinese kids." Girl. "You want a sip of my slushie?" Me. "Sharing drinks can give you mono. So can kissing." Girl. "I'm going to go sit somewhere else." Can you blame me for trying to jazz up conversations with my peers a little by talking about topics like Dr. Henry Lee's take on the Lacey Peterson murder? Eventually, I gave up engaging in mundane chats. Following a discussion about who was going out with whom was as hard for me as cataloging the mating rituals of a nomadic tribe in Papua New Guinea. My mother says sometimes I don't even try. I say I try all the time, and I keep getting rejected. I'm not even sad about it, really. Why would I want to be friends with kids who are nasty to people like me anyway? There are some things I really can't stand. 1. The sound of paper being crumpled. I can't tell you why, but it makes me feel like someone's doing that to all my internal organs. 2. Too much noise or flashing lights. 3. Having plans change. 4. Missing Crime Busters, which is on the USA Network at 4:30 every day, thanks to the wonders of syndication. Even though I know all 114 of the episodes by heart, watching them daily is as important to me as taking insulin would be to a diabetic. My whole day is planned around it, and if I can't have my fix, I get shaky. 5. When my mother puts my clothes away, I keep them in a rainbow order, ROYGBIV, and the colors can't touch. She does her best, but the last time she completely forgot about indigo. 6. If someone else takes a bite of my food, I have to cut off the part that his or her saliva has touched before I can eat any more of it. 7. Loose hair. It freaks me out, which is why mine is military short. 8. Being touched by someone I don't know. 9. Foods with membranes, like custards, or foods that explode in your mouth, like peas. 10. Even numbers. 11. When people call me retarded, which I am not. 12. The color orange. It means danger, and there's no rhyme for it in English, which makes it suspicious. Thea wants to know why I can tolerate things that are silver then, but I won't even rise to the argument. I have spent much of my 18 years learning how to exist in a world that is occasionally orange, chaotic, and too loud. In between classes, for example, I wear headphones. I used to wear this great pair that made me look like an air traffic controller. But Theo said everyone made fun of me when they saw me in the halls, so my mother convinced me to use earbuds instead. I hardly ever go to the cafeteria because A, there's no one for me to sit with, and B, all those conversations crossing each other feel like knives on my skin. Instead, I hang out in the teacher's room, where, if I happen to mention that Pythagoras did not really discover the Pythagorean theorem, the Babylonians used it thousands of years before Pythagoras was even a seductive gleam in his Grecian parents' eyes, they don't look at me as if I've grown a second head. If things get really bad, pressure helps, like lying under a pile of laundry or a weighted blanket, a blanket with little poly pellets inside that make it heavier. because the deep touch sensory stimulation calms me down. One of my therapists, a Skinner aficionado, got me to relax to Bob Marley songs. When I get upset, I repeat words over and over and talk in a flat voice. I close my eyes and ask myself, what would Dr. Henry Lee do? I don't get into trouble because rules are what keep me sane. Rules mean that the day is going to go exactly the way I am predicting it to be. I do what I'm told. I just wish everyone else would do it too. We have rules in our house. 1. Clean up your own messes. 2. Tell the truth. 3. Brush your teeth twice a day. 4. Don't be late for school. 5. Take care of your brother. He's the only one you've got. The majority of these rules come naturally to me. Well, except for brushing my teeth, which I hate doing, and taking care of Theo. Let's just say my interpretation of rule number 5 doesn't always synchronize with Theo's interpretation. Take today, for example. I included him in a starring role in my crime scene, and he got furious. He was cast as the perpetrator. How could he not see that as the highest form of flattery? My psychiatrist, Dr. Moon Murano, often asks me to rate anxiety-producing situations on a scale of 1 to 10. Case in point 3. Me. My mom went out to the bank and said she was going to be back in 15 minutes, and when it got to 17 minutes, I started to panic. And then when I called her, she didn't pick up on her cell, and I was sure she was lying dead in a ditch somewhere. Dr. Moon. On a scale of 1 to 10, how did that make you feel? Me. A 9. Note. It was really a 10, but that's an even number, and saying it out loud would make my anxiety level blow off the chart. Dr. Moon. Can you think of a solution that might have worked better than calling 911? Me. Doing my best share from Moonstruck impression. Snap out of it! I rate my days, too, although I haven't told this to Dr. Moon yet. High numbers are good days, low numbers are bad days. And today is a 1, between my fight with Theo and then the absence of the free sample lady at the grocery store. In my defense, I have worked out an algorithm to predict what she's going to serve, and maybe I wouldn't have been upset if it was the first Saturday of the month when she hands out vegetarian items. But today was a dessert day, for God's sake. I have been in my room since we got home. I bury myself under my covers and put a weighted blanket on top of that. I cue I Shot the Sheriff on my iPod on repeat and listen to that one song until 4:30, when it is time to watch Crime Busters and I have to go into the living room where the TV is. The episode is number 82, one of my top 5 ever. It involves a case where one of the CSI investigators, Rihanna, doesn't show up for work. It turns out she is taken hostage by a man racked with grief over his wife's recent death. Rihanna leaves behind clues for the rest of the team to solve, to lead them to where she is being kept. Naturally, I figure out the conclusion long before the rest of the CSI team does. The reason I like the episode so much is that they actually got something wrong. Rihanna gets dragged to a diner by her kidnapper and leaves a coupon for her favorite clothing store underneath her finished plate. Her colleagues find it and need to prove it's actually hers. They process it for prints using a small particle reagent followed by ninhydrin, when in reality you're supposed to use ninhydrin first. It reacts to the amino acid and then is followed by the small particle reagent, which reacts with fats. If you use the small particle reagent first, like they did in the episode, it would ruin the porous surface of the ninhydrin procedure. When I spotted the error, I wrote to the producers of Crime Busters. They sent me back a letter and an officially licensed t-shirt. The t-shirt doesn't fit me anymore, but I still keep it in my drawer. After watching the episode, my day definitely improves from a 1 to a 3. Hey! My mother says, poking her head into the living room. How are you doing? Okay, I reply. She sits down beside me on the couch. Our legs are touching. She is the only person I can stand having close to me. If it were anyone else, I would have moved away a few inches by now. "So, Jacob," she says, "I just want to point out that you did in fact survive the day without the free food sample." It's times like this I'm glad I don't look people in the eye. If I did, surely they would die on the spot from the contempt shooting out of mine. Of course I survived. But at what cost? "Teachable moment," my mother explains, and she pats my hand. "I'm just saying." "Frankly, my dear," I murmur, "I don't give a damn." My mother sighs. "Dinner at 6, Rhett," she says, even though it's always at 6, and even though my name is Jacob. At different times, the media have posthumously diagnosed certain famous people with Asperger's. Here's just a sampling. 1. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. 2. Albert Einstein. 3. Andy Warhol. 4. Jane Austen. 5. Thomas Jefferson. I am 99% sure not a single one of them had a meltdown in a grocery store and wound up breaking a whole shelf of relish in pickle jars. Dinner proves to be a painful affair. My mother seems driven to start a conversation, although neither Theo nor I is inclined to hold up the other end of it. She's just gotten another packet of letters from the Burlington Free Press. And sometimes she reads them out loud at dinner, and we make up politically incorrect responses that my mother would never in a million years write in her advice column. Case in point 4. "Dear Auntie M, my mother-in-law insists on cooking roast beef every time my husband and I come to visit, even though she knows that I am a lifelong vegetarian. What should I do next time it happens? Steamed in South Royalton." Dear Steamed, turnip your nose at her and walk away. Sometimes the questions she gets are really sad. Like the woman whose husband had left her and who didn't know how to tell her kids. Or the mom dying of breast cancer, who wrote a letter for her baby daughter to read when she grew up, about how she wished she could have been there for her daughter's high school graduation, her engagement, her first child. Mostly, though, the questions come from a bunch of idiots who made bad choices. How do I get my husband back now that I realize I shouldn't have cheated on him? Try being faithful, lady. What's the best way to win back a friend you've hurt with a nasty remark? Don't say it in the first place. I swear, sometimes I can't believe my mother gets paid to state the obvious. Tonight she holds up a note from a teenage girl. I can tell because the ink of the pen is purple and because the I in Auntie M has a heart over it where the dot should be. "Dear Auntie M," she reads, and just like always, I picture a little old lady wearing a bun and sensible shoes. Not my own mother. "I like a guy who already has a girlfriend. I know he likes me 'cause... God, don't they teach you how to spell these days?" "No," I answer. "They teach us to use spell check." Theo looks up from his plate long enough to grunt in the direction of the grape juice. "I know he likes me because," my mother edits, "he walks me home from school and we talk for hours on the phone, and yesterday I couldn't take it anymore and I kissed him and he kissed me back." Oh, please, someone get this girl a comma. Then she frowns at her loose leaf paper. "He says we can't go out, but we can be friends with benefits. Do you think I should say yes? Sincerely, Burlington Buddy." My mother glances at me. "Don't all friends have benefits?" I stare at her blankly. "Theo?" she asks. "It's a saying," he mutters. "A saying that means what, exactly?" Theo's face turns bright red. "Just Google it. Just tell me. It's when a guy and a girl who aren't going out hook up, all right?" My mother considers this. "You mean like have sex? Among other things? And then what happens? I don't know, Theo says. They go back to ignoring each other, I guess. My mother's jaw drops. That is the most demeaning thing I've ever heard. This poor girl shouldn't just tell that guy to go jump in a lake. She ought to slash all four of his car tires and... Suddenly, she pins her gaze on Theo. You haven't treated a girl like that, have you? Theo rolls his eyes. Can't you be like other mothers and just ask me if I'm smoking weed? Are you smoking weed? She says. No! Do you have friends with benefits? Theo pushes back from the table and stands up in one smooth move. Yeah, I have thousands. They line up outside the front door, or haven't you noticed them lately? He dumps his plate in the sink and runs upstairs. My mother reaches for a pen she's tucked into her ponytail. She always wears a ponytail because she knows how I feel about loose hair swishing around her shoulders, and begins to scrawl a response. Jacob, she says, be a sweetheart and clear the table for me, will you? And off goes my mother, champion of the confused, doyen of the dense, saving the world one letter at a time. I wonder what all those devoted readers would think if they knew that the real Auntie M had one son who was practically a sociopath and another one who was socially impractical. I'd like a friend with benefits, although I'd never admit that to my mother. I'd like a friend, period. For my birthday last year, my mother bought me the most incredible gift ever, a police scanner radio. It operates by receiving frequencies that regular radios cannot, ones assigned by the federal government in the VHF and UHF range above the FM stations, and which are used by police, fire, and rescue crews. I always know when the highway patrol is sending out the sanding trucks before they arrive. I get the special weather alerts when a nor'easter is coming. But mostly I listen to the police and emergency calls, because even in a place as small as Townsend, you get a crime scene every now and then. Since Thanksgiving alone, I have gone to 2 crime scenes. The first was a break-in at a jewelry store. I rode my bike to the address I heard on the scanner and found several officers swarming the storefront for evidence. It was the first time I got to see spray wax being used on snow to cast a footprint, a definite highlight. The second crime scene was not really a crime scene. It was the house of a kid who goes to my school, who is a real jerk to me. His mother had called 911, but by the time they got there, she was standing at the front door, her nose still bleeding, saying that she didn't want to press charges against her husband. Tonight, I have just gotten into my pajamas when I hear a code on the scanner that is different from any I've heard before, and I've heard plenty. 10:52, ambulance needed. 10:50, motor vehicle accident. 10:13, civilians present and listening. 10:40, false alarm, premises secure. 10:54, livestock on highway. Right now, though, I hear this. 10:100, which means dead body. I don't think I've ever gotten dressed so quickly in my life. I grab a composition notebook, even though it's a used one, because I don't want to waste any time, and I scroll down the address that keeps getting mentioned on the scanner. Then I tiptoe downstairs. With any luck, my mother is already asleep and won't even know I'm gone. It's bitterly cold out, and there are about 2 inches of snow on the ground. I'm so excited about the crime scene that I'm wearing sneakers instead of boots. The wheels of my mountain bike skid every time I go around a turn. The address is a state highway, and I know I've reached the right spot because there are 4 police cars with their flashing blues on. There is a wooden stake with police tape, yellow, not orange, fluttering in the wind, and a visible trail of footprints. An abandoned car, a Pontiac, sits on the side of the road covered in ice and snow. I take out my notebook and write, "Vehicle has been abandoned for at least 12 hours pre-storm." I duck into the edge of the woods as another police car arrives. This one is unmarked and ordinary, except for the dome police light magnetically affixed to the top. The man who gets out of it is tall and has red hair. He's wearing a black overcoat and heavy boots. On one of his hands, he has a Dora the Explorer Band-Aid. I write this in my notebook, too. "Captain," an officer says, coming out from between the trees. He's dressed in a uniform, with heavy gloves and boots, too. "Sorry to call you in." The captain shakes his head. "What have you got?" "A jogger found a body in the woods. Guy's half naked and there's blood all over him." "Who the hell goes jogging at night in the dead of winter?" I follow them into the woods, careful to stay in the shadows. There are searchlights illuminating the area around the body, so that the evidence can be fully recorded. The dead man is lying on his back. His eyes are open. His pants are gathered around his ankles, but he is still wearing his underwear. The knuckles of his hands are bright red with blood, as are the bottoms of his palms and his knees and calves. His jacket is unzipped, and he's missing one shoe and one sock. All around him, the snow is pink. "Holy crap," the captain says. He kneels down and snaps on a pair of rubber gloves that he takes from his pocket. He examines the body up close. I hear two more sets of footsteps, and another man steps into the pool of light, escorted by a uniformed officer. The uniformed officer takes one look at the dead guy, goes totally pale, and throws up. Jesus!